into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports. Ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
Now then, you're very welcome along. So happy to tell you that Vodafone are giving British and Irish Lions fans the chance to become a Lion. There is a new official Lions Tour app. More details on hashtag Unite the Pride. And as well as that, a couple of Lions legends have been announced as official Vodafone British and Irish Lions ambassadors. And we're very happy to say two of them join us now. We have Paul O'Connell, captain in 2009, part of the 05 New Zealand Tour and the winning tour in Australia in 2013. And we have Sam Warburton as well, captain of the 2013 series and captain of the drawn series against New Zealand in 2017. Lads, great to have you with us. Paul, you can hear us okay. How you doing?
I'm very well, Joe. Can hear you fine. Thanks.
Great to have you with us. Sam Warburton, welcome to the show. Lovely to have you on.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me. Good to meet you guys.
I was flicking through your book in advance of having you on, Sam, over the weekend. Really enjoyed it. Relieved to say, no awkwardness here. Paul O'Connell makes your best 15 of players you've ever played against. He's in there along
of
Sam Whitelock.
Of course he does. Of course he does. Wouldn't have anyone else.
I was interested as well. You had David Pocock in ahead of Richie McCaw. Give us the very educated word on that. How do you split those two?
I'll tell you what, a stat came out the other day, actually. That popped up on my Twitter feed, and it said the most jackal turnovers won from open tie flankers in this sort of recent sort of generation out of tier one nations. Second was 90 turnovers, and number one was 142 turnovers with David Pocock. And bearing in mind, the guys who were second, third, and fourth on the list had over 100 caps, and all got over 100 caps. You know, I think it was McCaw was number two with 140 caps, whatever. But Pocock had 78 caps, and he eclipsed everyone by over 50 turnovers. So there's an actual seven specialists at contact area. There might have been players who had more strings to their bow, but as an actual specialist over the ball, I was just personally my toughest opponent. And obviously McCaw is one of the all-time greats and one of the best players I've played against, without a doubt. But if I was going to pick a player, which, and I guess it's my style of player as well, that physicality over the ball, Pocock was unrivaled in my opinion.
You could get over the ball as well in your time. Paul, what was the tactic when it was Dan Lydia chop tackling and Warburton jumping in straight afterwards?
There was only one tactic. You had to get the job done before the tackle was finished. So you had to get your clean out done, get the guy off the ball before the tackle was finished. And that'd be the one-liner all week. No separation would be another line you'd be using, which meant there had to be no time between the tackle being finished and you cleaning the ruck. So that was the quickest way to avoid a Warburton getting on the ball, was to try and get him away from it before the tackle was finished. And because we didn't even practice really under Joe Schmidt anyway, we didn't really practice cleaning guys off the ball, because it was almost like, I suppose, not learning how to prevent the fire, but learning how to put out the fire. Once Sam was locked on it, it was game over, ball burst. He was taking it, and it was either going to be a penalty or a turnover. So all the focus was about trying to get the job done before the tackle was finished.
As an aside, Sam, and we'll get stuck into Lions nostalgia now, and that ostensibly is the point of this chat, but as an aside, seeing as it's come up just now, when you're jackling over the ball and you're taking one hit, then another hit, and maybe if the referee allows a third hit, what's going through your head then?
Feels amazing. I love it. I genuinely miss that feeling of getting smacked and being able to resist it and get up. And I always hate those players who win a jackal turnover. They stand up with their chest puffed out with the ball in their arms so everybody can see on the telly they've won it. I always like just to try and win it on this quietly and then just leave the ball on the floor and just walk away on my own business. I knew the coaches and the statisticians would have seen it, but I didn't need to give it a big one. But I love that physical battle of people trying to move you. As I got older, it became more of a worry for me then, because I was struggling with my knees. I had a couple of knee ops, and obviously I had neck operation and stuff. So suddenly it wasn't as fun when I was 28 with a couple of kids, and you suddenly start reevaluating things. But when I was young and didn't have you don't have a care for your body when you're young 20s, you just fly into things head first. So I absolutely love that part of the game, and that's why I played it. But ironically, that's kind of what finished me at the same time as well. But yeah, I love that feeling of getting down there and doing some of the dirty stuff, which perhaps some of your more silky backs don't like to do.
We're into a Lions season, and players will be asked about the Lions ahead next year, and they'll tell the usual lie that they're not thinking about it, and they're completely unaware that the Lions is happening. But of course, they're all thinking about it. I'm looking forward to seeing the new app. Paul, I'm told you did a motion capture shoot as part of the app, so it was you. I think Ian McGeachan was there as well, and Sam. Tell us about all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so me and Sam were the most recently retired guys doing it. So we had those motion capture suits on, a kind of a skin-tight black suit with all these white dots down along the arm, on the chest, down along the legs, across the head. And all the movements you do then appear on a computer screen as a kind of a matchstick man. But they were asking us about various movements for rugby. And Ian McGeachan was getting frustrated watching it. So he actually went and put on, I mean, I don't know what age Sir Ian McGeachan is. He must be mid-60s, almost 70 now. But yeah, I hope I'm not insulting him with that estimate of his age. But he went and put on a suit. He didn't have any runners on, so he had these kind of Eden Park winkle picker shoes. And then he had an unbelievable Paul Mescal gold chain hanging out over the skin tight as well. And he was trying to show the guys all the rugby movements, and he was trying to give out the back passes and stuff as well. So I think when some people sign up to the app and become a digital line, there'll probably be some of it will be in the geek, which is kind of funny. But the image of him in the winkle pickers and the Paul Mescal gold chain, I'll never forget.
A point to jump off on you two. So, I mean, it's great. We have the captains from the 09, 13, 17 tours. Sam, you have a love-hate relationship with captaincy, I think it's fair to say, across your career. 22 years of age, you'd played 10 times for Wales, and Warren Gatland asks you to start captaining the team, and that leads into the 2011 mm-hmm. World Cup. You're the youngest captain in World Cup history at 22 years of age. I hate captaincy is something you say pretty early on in this thing. I hate being alone in my room. I hate doing the press. I hate the sponsorship. And I know some of the players don't think I should be captain. So I can see the hate aspect of the love-hate relationship.
Yeah, that's why I'm doing a sponsorship gig with Vodafone. So
you didn't hear it that much.
Yeah, didn't it? What it is, I think, I was actually chatting to Paulie about this the other day. Like, if I was captain now, I'd enjoy it because I'm much older. I got a completely different perspective. I think it was because it was given to me very young. So, like, I've only just turned 32 now, and I kind of think if I was still playing, like, the captaincy, I really enjoy it now, and I feel even... I enjoyed it when I was on the 17 tour. I felt very different then. I was 4 years more experienced than 13. 13, I didn't feel I was the right guy to do it. I thought, for example, I thought it could have been Paul. I thought it might have been Brian. And then it was given to myself, which I sort of felt a little bit... Not like I didn't deserve it, but I thought it might have come too soon. Then 17, I was actually waiting for that phone call, thinking like about Warren Gatland. I was like, please call me, because I do feel I'm the right guy to do it for this tour. So it was when I was young. I struggled with it when I was young because I found it hard at 22 to get my head around players who had like 80, 90 more caps than me. And some of them had like 12 years more experience of international rugby than myself. So it was a bit of like an inferior complex, really. But the first 3 years, I found it really hard. And then after the last couple of years of my career, I found it fine. You could just grow with the role, and you sort of get nurtured into the role, and you get used to it with experience. But yeah, when I was young, I found it a bit of a distraction. But weirdly, I kept playing well with it, so that's why I managed to hold on to it. But there was times when I got older that I thought, it sounds the wrong thing to say in a team sport, but you need to be a bit selfish sometimes. And if you're not doing the business yourself, it doesn't matter what title you've got, what you've achieved, you're not going to get picked. So there's times I felt it was a distraction, and I stepped down from it so I could focus on my playing career. But yeah, definitely the younger days, I didn't enjoy it, but I grew to enjoy it as I got towards the end of my career.
Because you would describe yourself as introverted, amongst other characteristics. For instance, your first ever pre-match speech at 22, Wales captain. You got the notepad out all week, you were working very hard on what you wanted to say, and you came out with what you describe as a bunch of mumbled irrelevant crap. It's just a pity a camera wasn't there to catch this bunch of mumbled irrelevant crap. But you got better at it, clearly. You grew to be more comfortable at it. When 13 came around and you're Lions captain, I can see how that's an extra weight. You must have been worried, for instance, how Paul O'Connell, amongst others, might have felt about you getting the captaincy. That must have crossed your mind in advance of going out to Australia.
Yeah, no, it does cross your mind. But I remember that one. It was, we were in Twickenham playing England, and I used to try and plan what I was going to say, and then I realised quickly after about a year, I was like, you can't do that. I would just literally then, I get captains who speak to me, like, I never know what to say pre-match. I say, mate, like, I was exactly the same. What I used to do then was, when you speak before warm-up, that's kind of a bit more tactical when the boys are not quite at that sort of height of arousal, you know, ready to play a game when you're extremely sort of motivated to go out and get ready for kickoff. So before warm-up, I'd speak about maybe the three key tactical points that we've been working on that week when everybody is calm and composed to make sure that they get that for the final time. And then before you go out for the game then, you sort of just realise then you've got so many leaders in your team. Defensive captain might speak, somebody from the forwards might contribute, and then you just round it off with like 10, 20 seconds, which sounds like not much, but it's enough. You don't need to do too much. So I remember the first Lions tour we had in 13, and we were training, and I don't really speak in the week until maybe Thursday, but then Friday before the game, I'll start sort of speaking to the group a bit more. And we had a training session Monday or Tuesday, and we were training in Wales, and we finished a forward session, and we were getting pretty heated in the session. And I don't speak after most sessions, but I remember Paulie just rounded off a session and spoke, you know, spoke passionately about what our job was for the game coming up and the tour. And it was perfect. And we walked off. I don't know if you remember this, Paul. Then maybe you come to him and you're like, oh, sorry, mate. I didn't mean to step on your toes there. And I was like, mate, that's actually perfect, because I don't really round up sessions too often, particularly in the beginning of the week, and Tuesday's normally a big hit out day. So anytime you want to chip in, and you need all these guys to chip in on the Lions tour, there's never just one voice you need to hear. I said, that's great. And then I remember you said, that's kind of how you and Brian worked. You know, Brian might speak towards the end of the week and match days, but then you were kind of G'ing the boys up during the week. And I was like, no, that dynamic works for me, you know. So you quickly work out these things. But a Lions tour, that's why as captain you get plaudits, but it's never... You've got like 15 captains in a Lions tour. Mm. Like, you know, I could say that 13 tour, Paul O'Connell, Brian O'Driscoll, say myself, Alan Wynne-Jones, Johnny Sexton, Owen Farrell, Gethin Jenkins. It's crazy the amount of senior players you have. To not tap into all those would be silly. So, yeah, never, you know, humility is probably one of the best traits you could have as a captain, and being able to realise that you need the input of a lot of other guys is a good thing.
Paul, firstly, honest question for honest answer. Were you disappointed to miss out in the captaincy in 13?
No, I wasn't. I was delighted to get picked on the tour, because I'd had a back operation on New Year's Eve. Just before that tour, I missed the Six Nations, and I managed to just get back and played a really good game for Munster in the European Cup with Warren Gatland and Rob Howley, and I think Graham Rowntree watching. So I was just happy to get picked on the tour. I was in real bonus territory, and I was kind of delighted not to be the captain, because I'd spent most of my career, you know, captaining Ireland at times and then captaining Munster for a good number of years. So to be on the tour and to have that weight off my shoulders was actually very enjoyable. So it didn't bug me. I didn't act any differently than if I wasn't captain, really. And Sam would say that I would have done that when Anthony Foley was captain of Munster and Brian O'Driscoll. I'd constantly be talking to people and at people and arguing with people. And it allowed, I think certainly at times, I would say it annoyed Anthony and Brian, but I'd say at times it allowed them to sit back, concentrate their own game and pick and choose their moments. And I think we kind of did that as well in the 2013 Lions with Sam. The Welsh boys don't speak a massive amount. Anyway, that's their nature. You know, all the Irish guys, we have an opinion on everything. And the English guys would be very similar. And there was very few Scottish guys ever there anyway. But the Welsh boys are very, very quiet. And I remember sitting down beside Ian Evans, who's one of the funniest guys you've ever met in your life, the second row from Wales. And at the end of the tour, I'd been out injured. And we had a meeting. We had a meeting, and I was just sitting at the back beside Ian Evans, and someone started speaking, and he said to me, he said, who put the 10 pence in him? as in it's like a jukebox. And I was thinking, my God, what was he saying when I spoke in nearly every other meeting? But I think that's the nature of the Welsh boys, is the coaches do a lot of the stuff early on in the week, Sam, don't they? The players take it on, but they still say very little towards the end of the week.
Do you know what? Yeah, no, you're definitely right. I was doing a question answer with Warren Gatland once, and he said exactly that. Somebody said, what are the best traits from each nation? And he said, the Irish have the best thinkers, they challenge the coaches the most, and the best communicators. And he said that was Ireland's best trait that he sort of realised when you work with those players. And like, you notice that when you watch the DVDs back, and a lot of the Irish guys are the ones in the changing room being vocal, talking to the team, motivating everyone, where, you know, Welsh guys are very... They are. We'd have a team meeting and Warren would be like, please, someone just speak. But Welsh guys are very much doers, you know, very much doers. Yeah. They tell us what to do and we go with it. And it might only be on the team run on the Friday where we get together and we plan out what we want to do. And then we take over for the rest of the week. But yeah, Monday to Thursday is very coach-led with Wales, where I think Ireland was much more of an integrated approach. But not sure where that comes from. I don't know whether that's from younger level. It's quite an interesting debate, actually. But yeah, I definitely agree. And Warren agrees with what Paulie said as well.
Why do you think it is that way, Paul?
I think it's something that the RFU are big into, is kind of leadership development. And I suppose a lot of our coaching practices, and probably similar to Wales, a lot of our coaching practices come from New Zealand. Wayne Smith would be, I suppose, the father of the query theory in coaching, in that you constantly ask the players questions to get their opinion, but also to check for understanding and to check for learning. And I think from an Irish point of view, and if you want an Irish player to execute a plan, he needs to kind of own the plan a little bit. And I think the IRFU, I think that's across all levels of coaching. You know, when I worked with Noel McNamara with the Irish 20s for one season, he was just so collaborative with the young players. And it doesn't come naturally to a young player. It has to be learned. They have to be taught how to have an opinion and how to express that opinion. But I think it's just something, whether it came from Declan Kidney or Eddie O'Sullivan, I'm not so sure, but it's just something that's in Irish rugby. It's part of our culture. It's the way we do it. Players are really encouraged to have an opinion. And even you look at Stuart Lancaster and Leinster, if you hear any of his webinars, which he did over the course of the lockdown, he would constantly be trying to develop the leadership capabilities of young players, trying to encourage them to have an opinion and trying to own what they're doing. And I think that ownership is a big part of why Irish teams have been successful in recent years. I'm not sure why the Welsh are a little bit quieter. You know, it's no less effective. Look at the success of their national team, but they definitely are. There's a little bit of tall poppy syndrome sometimes in Wales. You know, Sam mightn't agree with me or might disagree with me, but I think if you're seen to be above your station, you get chopped down a little bit. Whereas I think in Ireland, you're encouraged to have an opinion. And, you know, sometimes we probably talk a little bit too much. I think you probably, if you had a little bit of a balance between the two, you guys like Martin Williams, Sam, Geoffin Jenkins, picking and choosing their moments, I thought that was really effective for us on Lions Tour. So I'm not sure where it comes from, but it's definitely part of the Irish rugby culture.
And Sam, were you thinking, God, will these Irish lads ever just shut up for 5 minutes?
I agree with what Paul says, actually. And like, from a Welsh perspective, it's very much one of those things that, like, no one's ever going to be bigger than the team, in the sense, like, not that I'm saying that's what you should do. I love the sort of confidence that players should bring. And Warren would try and get that out of the Welsh boys, because he could probably sense that we weren't like that naturally. So, you know, he would turn up on a Tuesday or Monday session as we were playing Ireland, like a big game. Like, Wales' biggest game was actually playing Ireland. And for the fans, it was England, but for the players and coaching staff, playing Ireland was our biggest game. And he would say, right, yeah, he hadn't been a team. And he'd say, starting 15, I want you to put the bibs on. And it was obviously a Monday. We normally get an out of the team on a Tuesday or sometimes Thursday. And nobody would want to walk over to the bibs, but the only player who would Mike Phillips would walk straight over and pick up number 9 every time. And then after then, we suddenly realised that that's what he actually wanted. He wants players to almost pick themselves, and he wants you to display that level of confidence and self-belief. And it took a few years to change the psyche of the Welsh players, but yeah, we soon then had much shorter, sharper meetings where if somebody was listening from the outside, from a press perspective, for example, or a fan, they might think we were arrogant. But that's just the mindset you've got to be in to play pro sport. And we probably thought, coming into the environment as young players, that you need to be like grateful and show a lot of humility. But actually, when you want to be cutthroat, ruthless in that environment, you've got to back yourself and your team 100%. So yeah, that was probably one of Warren's biggest challenges with the Welsh team.
And Sam, that's very interesting. Why was the Ireland game the biggest one for the players?
I don't know. I think it's a combination. From a management point of view, there's obviously the history with Warren Gatland and Ireland. And from a Welsh region perspective as well, we never beat the Irish provinces. You know, we got our pants pulled down by Munster and Leinster and Ulster on regular occurrences. You know, I can't actually remember. I think I got one away win in Ireland against Munster. I got two. In my career, I got two away regional wins in Ireland, you know. That was it. So I think because we struggled to beat them at regional level so much, it made it pretty sweet when we could beat them at an international level, if I'm being honest. So I think, you know, the chances of beating Munster away from home and Leinster was, you know, very far, few and far between. But going away to Ireland and getting a good win was realistic for us as a national team. But I do think it was pretty much an even 50-50 split between Wales and Ireland. You know, we had some fantastic battles. Wales, Ireland and England in my career was always a 50-50 split with wins and losses.
And was there ever a kind of resentment there, you know, that the regions hadn't quite got their act together in the way that the provinces over here had? And almost this sense that, yeah, look, they win Heineken Cups and they think they're great, but actually, when we get our best 15 against their 15, we have the edge in them. We're winning more Grand Slams. We're getting to World Cup semi-finals, and yet we have to, you know, have it at club level non-stop. Is that feels like it's there a little bit.
Well, do you know what? It's the main question. And maybe you guys in Ireland don't realise it, but the biggest question in Welsh club rugby anyway is, why can't we replicate what the Irish provinces do? And no one actually, you know, it's very difficult, the question. You know, I don't think Wales is as affluent as places like Ireland, like Dublin, for example. So obviously, like, sponsorship and money is, you know, Wales isn't an affluent area in general compared to the UK, you know. So the money is not in Wales as it would be in perhaps some places in Ireland and particularly in England. So the national game is what keeps the club game alive, really. So that international rugby, the game would struggle, to be honest. But no one actually knows. You know, Ireland have... You've got to give credit, because I always would say, oh, money these days buys you a good team in pro sport. Like, you know, pro sport is about money, but you can't help but look at some of the young players that Ireland are producing, particularly from Leinster. And they must have a fantastic college system and an academy system, and nobody must slip through the fishnet, you know, if they show any sort of talent, you know, because there's such a good pool of players over there. Whereas in Wales, we don't seem to have the same depth as they do in Ireland. But that is the big question in Wales. Why haven't we had success? And to be honest, no one knows the answer. Otherwise, we would have created it. So that's an ongoing problem in Wales at the minute.
To bring this back to the Lions then, that was a very interesting tangent. Paul, you experienced the full gamut then. 2005, not an enjoyable experience. And we've talked to you about that before. 2009, you know, that fork in the road moment, and the old school approach seemed to return, and then 2013, a winning tour. And it seemed like a continuation of the theme of 2009. You might give us a sense of that experience, those three tours, and the difference in approach.
Yeah, well, 2005 was a very tough tour. I think Clive Woodward tried something different. He brought 44 players. He brought 10 coaches. He kind of picked his probably first choice test team in and around very early on, even maybe before we went on the tour. So there was a midweek team and there was a Saturday team, but there was a midweek coaching staff. And a Saturday coaching staff as well. And we were very often split in different hotels, you know, so we tried to base ourselves in Auckland quite a bit, and the other team would move away. So it was kind of a really splintered tour. And it didn't work. I mean, you know, we didn't perform as a team. We didn't come together as a team. You know, we were very, I suppose, unlucky to lose Delalio early on, then to lose Brian O'Driscoll, then to lose Richard Hill, who were probably three of the best players and big leaders, big influencers in the dressing room and in the group. And probably the rest of us then as senior players didn't stand up. So we came across an incredible New Zealand team who played amazing rugby, and we were beaten 3-0, but it was a very tough tour. There was there was very little good in it. There's very little good that I remember in it. And, you know, you've heard all the stories we ruined on our own and things like this. But in 2009, we effectively went with two head coaches, kind of, Warren Gatland and Sir Ian McGeachan. And if there's one thing Sir Ian McGeachan knows, he kind of is a custodian of some of the things that works with the Lions. I remember one of the first meetings I had with him, they were just finishing off one of their selection meetings, and he was just saying, you know, it's hard to believe that I didn't realize this before, but he was saying selection is incredibly important. It's the most important thing we can possibly do, besides all the facilities and all the other high performance aspects. Picking the right people to go on the tour is really important. And then he said, every single player feeling he can get picked for the first test is really important as well. That is so important to the Lions. And he kind of has a whole load of these little rules in the back of his head that need to happen for the Lions to be successful or competitive. And you'd hear him dropping those. He'd tell stories all the time about Jason Leonard in the 1997 Lions tour, going on the tour, first choice prop, wasn't picked for any of the test matches, but how good a job he did of preparing the other props. Now, he tells that story in his Scottish accent, and, you know, he tells it really well, and he makes other people want to be like them. And he has loads of these little stories, little anecdotes and little rules in the back of his head that he feels you need to do for the Lions to be run well. And he did that in 2009. I mean, we played the Welsh game plan at the time, which for Welsh players, it's incredibly easy to learn. It takes about 15 minutes to learn. And it gets everyone on the same page really quickly. It's a lot easier to do now because a lot of the game plans that teams use, I think because of YouTube and analysis, everyone knows the type of games that people play. And if a coach says we're going to play this way, nearly every player can drop into it straight away. It wasn't like that in 2009, but right. We knew the Welsh way of playing from analysing them. The Welsh players that were on the tour obviously knew it. The Wasps players that were on the tour knew it because they had played it with Wasps as well. So you had these on-field coaches and players as well. And so we had this simple game plan. You know, you're Sean Edwards coaching the defence. You know, he's highly detailed, but he makes it all very, very simple for players as well. And we got on the same page really quickly. One thing that they did as well, and sorry for the long answer, I mean, I remember we trained, they used to bring a gym to the training grounds in 2009. They used to set it up beside the pitch. So we used to arrive to training. We do weights while the backs did their backs moves. The backs would do weights while the forwards did some lineouts and scrums. We'd take a half an hour break to have some coffee and a bit of food and some protein or whatever it was. They'd roll out a TV onto the pitch, which they had a small little generator for. We'd do a 15-minute meeting. We trained for an hour. We'd be done by lunch. And they'd have us spend the rest of the day together, get to know one another, doing touristy things. And I think that's one thing Sir Ian McGeachan was big into, was just trying to make sure we became a team. He wanted us to be technically and tactically right, but he wanted us to be a group of people that wanted to play for each other as well and had a bit of glue holding each other together when we got to the test matches. And, you know, it ended up, we socialised a lot. We were encouraged to go out a lot as well. You know, you guys like Adam Jones, the Welsh prop who didn't drink for a year so he'd get picked on the tour and then didn't stop drinking once he got on the tour. And it ended up being a real fun tour. We lost 2-1, but we played some great rugby. Mm. I think the fans and people watching on TV could see how committed we were, how much we wanted to win, how much we were enjoying playing with each other. And they got it right. And I think Gats then would have brought a lot of that on to the next tours in Australia and in New Zealand as well.
Mm. And maybe a culmination of that, Sam, because Paul, I always remember Paul coming back from the 2013 tour and talking about how Dan Lydiate had taken the time after sessions to show the Irish players the chop tackle. And yeah. That's, you know, that is the ultimate. Like, you guys are going to be going at it in the Six Nations very soon afterwards. So I'm wondering, you know, like that's an amazing level to get to, that you're sharing that kind of insight with each other. Unless, were you afterwards saying, Dan, what are you doing? Don't ever do that again. Don't show the Irish players anything.
No, you do share everything because your Lions does come first. You do whatever it takes to get the Lions to win. But there's, especially like Paul alluded to with the analysis, there's one thing knowing what's coming with the team tactically. There's another thing stopping it. So we knew that when we played our game plan back then. We knew all teams knew our game plan. Mm. It was, you know, hit Jimmy Roberts at first phase, get our three biggest ball carriers from the forward pack on the next three phases, come back to the open side of the strike move with another heavy-loaded back like George North or Cuthbert. And you'd like to think out of those first five or six phases, one of them would have made a bust. And that was almost the game plan. But there's one thing knowing it, and there's another thing for teams to stop it. I think we got to about 2014, 15, and teams were coming onto it and they were matching us from a physical point of view, and that game plan slowly evolved. And then defensively, our game plan was very much, and that was actually thrown in for the quarter final for the 2011 World Cup. We hadn't really had a low tackle focus at all under Sean Edwards, but Ireland, you know, that was when like Sean O'Brien was rampaging best, you know,
and Stephen Ferris.
Your back row was Heaslet, Ferris, and O'Brien, like a phenomenal back row, probably one of the best back rows I played against in that World Cup back row. And so obviously the ball carrier meters in those three alone was sky high in that World Cup. So we just threw as a curveball tactic that every single tackle has to, and it's difficult to do that these days. It's easier said than done. But back then we said, right, every single tackle has to be low. And I think Sean O'Brien, we had a stat back, you know, that whole game made something like 5 meters, because all of a sudden you've just got players like, you know, myself and Dan and the rest of the team just going for laces all the time. And we had quite a few players who were strong over the ball, so we could compete over the ball doing that. And that wasn't a tactic we took into every game. That was just a one-off tactic for that quarter final, which paid off, right, fortunately. But that was a Sean Edwards tactic, which was very cute, and that worked well for us.
Right, okay. The image lots of people will have from 2013 and the finale against Australia is, for different reasons, you, Sam, you, Paul, and Brian O'Driscoll in your suits for that final test. So that's bittersweet. To what extent bitter, to what extent sweet, Sam?
Yeah, I remember we were actually, like, the celebrations were going on in the changing room, and you know, Daniel Craig had come in, boys are popping champagne, and like you get involved and stuff, but it's not the same unless you've gone through that 80 minutes yourself. It's not just the 80 minutes, it's all the physical effort from the training for the Monday to the Saturday, the emotional energy that saps from you throughout the whole week. You're on this roller coaster from like a Monday to a Sunday, just gradually going up and up and up and up until you peak at match day, then you come crashing back down at the final whistle. But until you go through all those physical and emotions, physical and psychologically, you know, we go through all that energy, it doesn't feel the same. And it was obviously, I was delighted, but my first thought as soon as we won, like, I was celebrating, it was amazing, but I thought I got to go on the 17 tour and finish off a series, because like I felt I couldn't take any credit whatsoever for that last game. That last game was amazing, but I guess I'm being a bit hypocritical, because then I think of the contribution that Brian and Paul made to that tour, and it was enormous, and it contributes massively towards the winning series, you know, massively. But without taking part, it is very definitely bittersweet. And then we sort of said that to each other in the change rooms. It was an amazing occasion, but couldn't help but think, I wish I was playing. Mm.
You must just inevitably, Paul, be a bit detached.
You are a little bit, but you know, you've probably been the guy that's played in the past where you've genuinely said that this is for everyone. So you just have to buy into it. I broke my hand in the first test, which is disappointing, because it hadn't been that bad. I mean, I'd gone for an x-ray just to make sure on the Monday afterwards, and I found out it was broken. So I didn't really expect, I played quite well in the first test, and I didn't expect I wasn't going to be playing in the second test. So I was gutted to be ruled out. And you are a little bit detached, you know, everyone wants to be first choice. You know, you have to be a team player, but everyone wants to be first choice, and that's a good thing. Competition is great for a squad, but it was tough watching it from the stands. It's funny, when I think when Murray put Jamie Roberts in for the try and we kind of realised we'd won it, I'm delighted to say that I wasn't thinking about money, but Ian Evans knew exactly what the bonus was for winning the test series, and started telling all the lads that were in the crowd, because it wasn't based on whether you started or how many test matches you've been involved in. So there was double celebrations when we realised it was a bonus.
Paul, were there players across the Lions tour that you had preconceptions about that were totally wrong, or players that you hit it off with and didn't expect you would?
There's loads of them, and you know you realise that all the preconceptions are wrong. You know, it's like probably what every player feels about Alan Quinlan when they look at him on a field and he's fighting with his own players, the referee and the opposition players, but the guys that play with him love him to bits, you know. And so, you know, your Matt Dawson would have been a guy that's, you know, spiky scrum half that no one likes to play against, but he was a great guy in the 2005 tour, very interested, always wanted to chat and always wanted to get to know people, even though it was such a tough tour. Mike Phillips is a guy I'd be very, very good friends with still to this day, but couldn't stand before we went on the tour. It turns out he's a brilliant character, great fun, loves a night out, trains the house down then all week, and was really... Like a lot of the Welsh boys, I suppose the Welsh boys have been grown up on the old stories of the Lions from the 1970s, and that there's such a big tradition for them to live up to. They're really passionate and emotional about the Lions. So many of the supporters you meet on the Lions tours are Welsh people that have been saving for it for 4 years. They've all these saving clubs and their rugby clubs to save up for the Lions tour. So Mike Phillips is just one of those classic guys that, you know, when you get to know him, he's an unbelievable character, great fun and a great guy to play with. Incredibly physically committed, emotionally committed. And he was great fun on those tours. And there's plenty of other guys, Lee Mears, Dan Lydiot, Jeff Parling, the Youngs brothers, all brilliant characters. And they all kind of give themselves over, you know. Even I remember in the 2013 tour, we'd had a bit of thing with line-out calls in 2005, obviously. We'd had a 2009 line-out calls were quite complicated as well. And Graham Rowntree just showed up in the 2009 tour with the English calls. And he said, this is what we're doing. No questions. Just learn them and get on with it. And they were actually very complicated themselves. They were very hard to learn. Some guys really struggled with them. Ian Evans, again, struggled with them for the whole tour. But he just said, this is what we're doing. And then you ended up with guys like Tom Youngs, Jeff Parling, who didn't use the fact that they knew the calls as a tool for selection for themselves. They just became on-field coaches, started showing guys English lineouts, and this is how it works, this is how the system works, totally gave over everything. And that kind of stuff builds morale in the group. Because generally speaking, the way you play or the things you do moves on so quickly. There isn't really a problem with sharing anyway.
Right. Sam, New Zealand for you then, captain again. Is Sam gone? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm still here. So my dog was barking, so I just opened the door. He wants to cuddle, he does.
You're a big dog lover, aren't you? That's right, through your book as well. Dogs. Oh, you're a sucker for them.
Yeah, he was barking then because he obviously wants to jump in with me. So I had to open the door for him. I thought he would have carried on barking through the interview. Sorry.
Well, no, it's all right. Well, not to embarrass you, but your mum had put the dog on the phone to you when you were away on tour.
Oh, yes. Oh, so I got my first cap. I got my first cap at 20. I was away in the USA. And, I was on the bench and didn't come on. So I went back to my hotel room. I was absolutely devastated because I thought I was good enough to play, and the coach didn't put me on. I went through all the week, the whole week, like building up for my first cap. I was the only substitute not used. So I went back to my hotel room. I rang home. I was like, they obviously watched it on telly. They were devastated. So I said, and my dog would talk to me, see? I said, can you put Ted on the phone? So they put Ted on the phone. I could make certain noises and he'd howl back at me and I was in bits then. But,
No one wants to hear this.
Most people miss their kids, Sam.
Yeah, I didn't have kids then. The kids would give me a bit more perspective. But back then, they were my boys, they were. So, I'm like since I finished playing now, I've recently become an ambassador for the local dogs home and stuff. I love dogs.
Well, listen, where was I? Oh, yeah, 2017. So, I mean,
anyway, rugby.
Yes, rugby. this is the pinnacle, obviously. And I don't think many people give the Lions a chance going to New Zealand, not least because of what happened in 05. So it is just remarkable that you drew the series and came so close to winning the thing. You know, so small things. Paul talked there about why South Africa was enjoyable, and it's training outside and you've got, you know, the TV outside and swapping over weights, and it's, you know, there's a colour about the whole thing. New Zealand is winter and it's dark and it gets, you know, dark early. And it seemed like in 05, lads boxed in their rooms with not much to do. How did you counter that in 17?
17 was hard. I don't know. I don't want to call anyone out. I don't know who made the fixture list or the schedule, but the schedule was brutal in the sense, I think we went to Auckland three or four separate times, you know, up and north, south, like we were just bouncing up and down New Zealand like a yo-yo. And we didn't have a day off together for about 5 weeks. And then on the sixth week, I remember actually waking up in my hotel room and thinking, wow, this is the first day that I'm waking up where I'm not training or not jumping on a plane to travel somewhere. 5 weeks, so it was a tough tour in that sense. And constantly playing, training, traveling, not much time to socialize apart from going to a local coffee shop or something. But the boys were great. And we went to Queenstown then and we had about 5 days in Queenstown. That was brilliant. And we had a fantastic 5 days together. Had 3 days completely off where boys were, you know, bungee jumping, going on like these sort of water boats, like skiing across through canyons and doing fantastic things. You've seen all the scenery of New Zealand, which was great, but that really sort of got the boys together then for the last 2 weeks. It was a real spike in morale going towards the end of the tour, which is a tough place. If you go down south Dunedin in what is New Zealand's winter, and it's flipping heck. It's, the temperature just drops by like 10 degrees down there from a 1 hour flight. It's crazy. So, I mean, I loved it. You really feel that, like all the places we went to, you're in the heart of New Zealand. I love the passion that their fans had. But yeah, nobody gave us a chance. But to be honest, like, I just completely ignored all that. And I know you can try and say to someone ignore it, but I knew nobody was going to give us a chance to even get a draw, never mind a win. Mm. But I had nothing else in my mind, and so did all the other players. And people might find it surprising. They think, oh, they're just saying that. But we had no other option or plan other than to win the series. And people will be surprised when they hear that. Like, really? You're being genuine? But you've got to think about it. You're picking, say, like a test team. You're picking 23 guys from four countries. You've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people, registered rugby players, who want to be in that one team. You've got the 23 most competitive, determined animals, rugby animals, talented rugby animals out of the four home nations. Like, if they're not going to believe it, then no one is. So it wasn't... Obviously, you go to press conferences and all the New Zealand press were saying about... One lady really tried to stir me up saying... she said, Sam, we've done an alarming interview. Quiz, with the New Zealand rugby public. And we asked 200 fans whether they could name as many Lions players as they could. And they could only name 3 to 5 players. What do you think? And I just like laughed. I was just like, what? You're not getting under my skin that easy. But like, we were just getting stuff like that all the time. Our bags arrived in New Zealand. We got off the plane. So like, you know, 40 hours door to door New Zealand, about 20 odd hours in the air, but all the transition and stuff. It's like 40 odd hours getting our bags off the plane and we're chucking them on the bus and stuff. And the guy from the airport was helping us. Was like, boys, like, they have just set you up with a guillotine. You haven't got a chance. I don't know what, this tour's not fair for you. And we were again just laughing, like we were getting it left, right and centre. Press conferences, New Zealand public, fans, like even back home, a lot of people didn't really believe it. But weirdly, we had this amazing belief within the group, like a genuine belief in the group that we were going to do something special. And that carried us through the whole tour. And it proved right, because otherwise you'd have no chance of going out there against all the odds, back-to-back world champions. If you don't believe it, you've got absolutely no hope in hell. But we did genuinely all think we were going to win the series, which is why now, even still 3 years later, I'm still gutted. Like, opportunity missed. They were 1 point away from beating New Zealand on their home soil on a test series. And that would have been unbelievable. Like, that was what I said to the boys on the last test going out there. I said, you know, this is our chance now. Like, don't be nervous about what can go wrong. You've got to be excited about the carrot that's dangling in front of us. And that's to be the greatest Lions team there's ever been. And that, all we needed was that last victory, which is why I'm so gutted we only got a draw, because we were so close to achieving that. So for me, it's still opportunity missed. But as time's gone on, I do appreciate that even still, it was a phenomenal achievement, you know, to go out there and get a draw. So as time goes on, I'm more satisfied with the tour. But again, still a little bit bittersweet at the same time.
I suppose they're not mutually exclusive views, you know, because I was wondering, were you frustrated? Because even in your book, you're talking about all the things you have to do across the 6 weeks, big and small, everything from getting your head around the tactics and training well to, you know, getting to bed early and not being on your phone before bed so you sleep well, all the tiny details. And you said, I reckon only 20% of the boys could honestly say they did that for the duration of those 6 weeks, which, given we took 41 players, means around 8 players did. And then you go on to say, no coincidence that some of those who did apply themselves properly were among the best performers. Johnny Sexton, Owen Farrell, Alwyn Jones, Mauro Itoje. So that hinted at a frustration.
Yeah, so for example, someone like, so say the professionalism that Paul would have displayed in 2013, he wouldn't even remember, but like it was a very Welsh thing to do extras. And like, you know, Paul in 2013, Jamie Heaslip, Johnny Sexton, those guys were stayed back after gym sessions and were doing extra, stayed back on the pitch and were doing extra. And the professional guys stand out like a sore thumb. And I just look at it as like a, I say in the Olympic Games, for example, are the Lions are Olympics. And I just think like you've got 2 months now to dedicate yourself to be the best professional you can be. Of course, you have to enjoy yourself. I'm not, you know, I think it's compulsory that you have to get together and have a few beers. That stuff's like a not negotiable. But I'm just meaning things like, I wonder how many players could look themselves in the mirror and think, I did absolutely everything I could do to make sure I was at my very best for those 6 or 7 weeks. And I think, mind you, I'm a little bit different. And not to everyone. There's a minority of players, I think, who are like myself, and I think Paul would have been one of those, who are very, you know, spend a lot of time on the computers and the laptops doing their due diligence, looking at opposition and their own game, the way they do apply themselves in training. A lot of guys go there, and I don't think they were as professional as perhaps I expected them to be. And that's where I often used to think in my career, I could be an individual athlete because I used to love living the professional lifestyle.
And sorry to interrupt, would you try and get in people's cases and highlight that to them?
No, because that's them. I would say, I would mention those things in meetings, but I wasn't going to police it because you can't change somebody's ways. How one person might prepare for a test match might be very different to how I prepare. So you have to respect that. Mm. But yeah, I was very, very professional. And I found it hard when I saw players, you know, drinking when they were playing within 4 days. You know, I couldn't understand that. Or if they weren't putting the time on the laptops and then, you know, they're getting lineouts wrong, I'm thinking, you know, no wonder you're not a test team player, but you get your start in test boys and they're all phenomenal professionals, which is why they get to the very top. So you got to be a superb player to get on the Lions tour, very talented player, but I think the hardest workers and the best professionals end up, you know, getting the job done, and they tend to be your test starters.
Mm. Paul, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I think, again, it's a little bit of the tall poppy syndrome. You know, some guys don't want to be seen to be complete nerds when it comes to chasing performance. I think it just happens in groups sometimes. Now, having said that, there is a little bit of a thing on a Lions tour that I was asked the other day, you know, what would you say to a young player that gets picked on the Lions? I would say try, be as professional as you can to get picked on this, and then be a little bit old school when you do get on it. I think it's important you train hard, you prepare well, you do your analysis, you do your extras, and you build relationships really now more than ever, probably by asking other players from other countries for advice, for help on things, to do extras with them, to look at the video with them and things like that. But the social aspect of it is really important. And you can, you know, if you have relationships, it's one of the things I think that Clive fell down with in 2005. You know, all the team building things that you do with a new team, they didn't need to do anymore in that English team because they had such strong relationships going back such a long time. So they could go away and room on their own because they already had built the relationships. Whereas you can't really do that on a Lions tour. You do need to do some of the silly things. You do need to have a few drinks. You do need to, for the guys that do drink, which are less and less now, you do need to do some team socials and some forced fun. And I'd be a believer in that. But I would take Sam's point at the same time, you know, that there'll always be a small percentage that are willing to do more than everyone else to try and win. And that's the way it is in every squad. You know, if you go to any session, there'll always be the same guys will always be the guys that are out early They'll be the same guys, that are out earlier, the same guys that will be there afterwards, late. And generally, they're probably the most successful guys as well.
Mm. I have got to jump in, actually. Like, people ask me, they say, what's the best team building you've done? And it sounds very unprofessional to say in a professional world of rugby now. But like, you can do all the flipping, rock climbing or orienteering, all these things in the world. Nothing gets the boys together like a good drink. And it happens on both tours. And it's the best thing that happens to the team, because they tend to do the big one early in the tour as well. You always have a big one to finish. But early in the tour, you'll have a big one. And it's brilliant, because I remember when we were in Carton House in Ireland, we had a big drink in Dublin. And like, a lot of funny things happened that night. And there are a lot of players doing things I never thought I'd see them do, which I'll take to the grave me, which are really funny times, you know. But you go to, I was going down to breakfast the next morning, and all you can hear is the clanging of cutlery, the laughter of boys, everyone talking, all just reminiscing about what happened the night before. Mm. And then you think, like, oh, we're a team. So, yeah, I completely agree. On a Lions tour, getting to know each other is imperative, and the best way to do that is literally through alcohol. And it sounds so unprofessional, but nothing bonds a team like a few beers. It works every single tour.
Yeah, I've no doubt. As a last one, because it was fascinating to pick your brains and all this stuff, was there anyone, Paul, because you said generally those hard workers tend to come to the top, and you know, Sam even said it was no coincidence that the real pros were the better performers on the tour. Were there any players in your time who just had you scratching your head, as in, this fella is just, you know, not ticking all the boxes he should be ticking, and yet come Saturday at kickoff, he's unbelievable?
There probably is loads of them. You know, there's a few Irish guys spring to mind that I won't mention. And I would have had the wrong attitude towards those guys. I would have thought there was no place for those guys on a team. But I disagree with that now. I mean, you look at the last dance with Phil Jackson and the Chicago Bulls team, and you think that a Dennis Rodman has absolutely no place on a team as successful as them. But Phil Jackson is probably one of the best coaches in the world, in any sport, playing with some of the most determined, focused, dedicated people in the world, feels that he is a senior player group that can manage this guy, and they can get the most out of him. And it turns out Rodman then, when he played, he actually wasn't a kind of a flair player. He was an incredible work rate player that just did all the dirty work and made other people good, made other people look good. And when I look back on my rugby career and I look back at some of the players that were like that, were like Rodman in that they probably weren't ultra dedicated. There's always a few of them that have a place in the team, that bring a bit of brevity to the team. They maybe bring a bit of paranoia to the senior players in the team, a healthy paranoia around how well you're prepared or how not prepared you are. But they might relax the environment a little bit. And, you know, everyone would think of a Simon Zeebo maybe when you talk of those kind of characters, but Simon Zeebo is an unbelievable competitor deep down. I mean, if Simon Zeebo did a fitness session today, we used to do a 1K test, I remember, in Munster towards the end of my time, and Felix Jones was the only guy that could beat Simon Zeebo in that test, and right, they would be sprinting neck and neck towards the finish line. Now, Simon probably wasn't perfect in his diet, but you know, he had a very good idea of his detail. And maybe I think people misjudge him at times. And a lot of those guys that do make it to the top, even though they appear to be very standoffish and they appear to be maybe not as dedicated as they are, in their own ways, they're probably preparing. You know, they're probably real competitors and they're probably preparing quite well in their own way. And I think even to see him playing the other day against for Racing, you could see how much it meant to him. You could see how committed he was. And I suppose sometimes in his laid-back attitude, we look for the guy that wears his heart on his sleeve. We look for the guy that prepares in the way that we all want him to prepare, out in the pitch first, out last to leave the pitch, on the computer for the longest. But I think some of those guys have their own way of preparing, and they do lighten the place. They bring brevity. And I wish I'd been more in my time, even though I got on great with Simon Zeba. I'm not speaking about him in general, but I wish I'd been more understanding of some of those guys. You know, everyone doesn't need to be a robot on the team. And I think it'd be very boring if they were.
Yeah, geez. Trapped in New Zealand with 41 Paul O'Connells and Sam Warburton. Bloody hell. Fellas, that was fascinating. That was brilliant. Great to have you with us. We're going to park the Lions chat. I know we're going to chat Six Nations in a couple of minutes' time, but the captains from 09, 13 and 17, fascinating to get your thoughts on all that. Sam Warburton, thanks so much. Paul O'Connell, thanks a million.
No problem. Thank you.
Cheers. Thank you.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.